From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Long after most foreign journalists left Beirut for their own safety, Robert Fisk is still there. On this edition of Fresh Air, Fisk tells us why he stayed, and he describes how the Gulf crisis looks from Lebanon. Also, if clothes make the man, then what about the toupee? Coming up, journalist and bald man Richard Sandomir gets fitted for a toupee, but it's purely for research. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new recording of Charles Ives' string quartets. And critic Maureen Corrigan wonders if after years of intrigue, greed, and backstabbing, the TV show Dallas has become a victim of changing American attitudes. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The State Department said today that Iraq has accepted President Bush's offer for talks on the Persian Gulf crisis. Acting U.S. Ambassador Joseph Wilson was called to the Iraqi Foreign Ministry today and informed of the decision. No exact dates have been set, but the State Department said that arrangements are now being made. President Bush proposed last week that Iraqi Foreign Minister Tariq Aziz visit Washington before December 15th. Secretary of State James Baker would then go to Baghdad before the January deadline set by the UN for the Iraqi withdrawal from Kuwait. General Colin Powell, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, said today that he believes a continuing American presence in the Gulf may be needed even after Iraq is forced out of Kuwait. NPR's Mike Schuster reports from London.
General Powell was delivering a lecture before an audience of military specialists in London. In a question and answer session, Powell said there will be a need for a greater American presence in the Gulf in the future. Powell suggested that other nations would also have to take part in whatever new security arrangements are agreed upon in the region, possibly involving the United Nations. As for American ground forces, Powell included them as a long-term possibility, but not necessarily the only one. He mentioned an American naval presence or new forms of military cooperation with the states of the region as other possibilities. There are many things that can be done, Powell said, to bring a measure of stability to the Persian Gulf. I'm Mike Schuster in London.
Israeli officials have warned that they expect the U.S. to destroy the Iraqi military threat. If not, they say Israel may have to take its own steps against Iraq. Linda Gradstein reports from Jerusalem.
Said Israeli Foreign Minister David Levy said that Israel is not encouraging the U.S. to go to war. But he said if Israel perceives that its existence is in danger, it will do whatever it has to stop that threat. Israeli newspapers reported today that privately Levy went even further. They said he met American Ambassador to Israel William Brown and told him that Israel expects the U.S. to get rid of the Iraqi military machine. The U.S. promised this at the beginning, Levy reportedly said, and this was one of the factors that went into Israel's decision to keep a low profile. Levy told the Knesset that Israel will take a much higher profile if it needs to. For National Public Radio, this is Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
A federal regulator charged today that the so-called Keating Five senators exerted undue pressure on behalf of what he said was probably the worst institution in America. William Black told the Senate Ethics Committee that the senators' intervention caused enforcement delays that raised the cost of the federal bailout. At the end of today's session, Committee Chairman Howell Heflin said the panel has voted to give limited immunity to a former Keating lobbyist, James Grogan, in exchange for his testimony. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained more than 30 points today to close at 2,610.4. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Robert Fisk, is one of two Western journalists still living in Beirut. Most of his colleagues left the city within the year after the kidnapping of AP Bureau Chief Terry Anderson, who was a close friend of Fisk's. Fisk has covered 14 of the 15 years of Lebanese civil war for the British newspapers The Times and The Independent. He was in Beirut for the Israeli invasion, the massacre at the Sabra and Shatila Palestinian refugee camps, the withdrawal of the PLO, and the bombing of the U.S. Marine headquarters. In the past couple of weeks, he's watched the withdrawal of the Christian and Muslim militias. This dramatic change in Beirut is the result of a national reconciliation pact signed by Muslim and Christian legislators a year ago in the sortie resort of Taif. Robert Fisk's book, Pity the Nation, The Abduction of Lebanon, has just been published in the States. So last Friday, he flew out of Beirut for a trip to America. I asked him about the risks he's exposed himself to by living in West Beirut.
Well, very much the risks that many Lebanese people have been exposed to. You know, we tend to feel that hostages in Lebanon is a peculiarly Western affair, but it's not. There have been tens of thousands of Lebanese taken hostage over the past 14, 15 years. And indeed, there are thousands of Lebanese who have simply disappeared and hundreds who are still held hostage and known to be alive in various prisons in Lebanon, some controlled by Syria's militias, some by Israel's militias, who languish in conditions every bit as bad and in some cases worse than the Western hostages.
What's the closest call you've had in the past couple of years?
There was an attempted kidnapping in 84 before many of the other journalists left when a car... I was driving down a street called Madame Curie Street in West Beirut. I should explain that earlier that day, quite by chance, I'd been interviewing a young Lebanese Christian who had been held hostage, and I was thinking as I drove down the street about my interview with him. And it was just after dark. It was about 7:15 in the evening. And a car came up behind me and put its headlights on high beam, a big, old, battered American limousine. And it obviously wanted to overtake, so I naturally put my foot on the brake and slowed slightly. And as he came level with me, the passenger door was thrown open, and a man with, I always remember he had wild flying hair, he pointed a Kalashnikov at my car and with his left arm pointed to the side of the road in ordering me to stop. And I remember I kept saying to myself, this is it, trying to shake myself out of the sort of quiet and comfortable life that I did have with my nice home in Beirut, saying, you know, this is the moment when I'm going to have to make a very serious decision. And I let his car get in front of mine and begin to pull in, and he thought I was pulling up. And there were other men with long hair, one of them I thought with a beard, but I can't be sure, in the back of the car. It was a green car. And as I got enough space, I looked on the left to try and go past the other side of him and pass him out. I put my foot on the accelerator. And it was through fear I did it, not through any kind of courage, although doing that I realized that I'd committed myself to trying to get away from him, which was in a way a comfort. And he chased me through the streets, I guess for 2 miles, and they were quite crowded. I was jumping in front of other cars with my car. I was trying to overtake and put cars between me and him. And eventually, I remember I thought that it was raining because I became covered in water and liquid, and I realized that at the time of year it couldn't be the case, and the window was shut. And only when I stopped the car 2 miles away near the hotel where many of the journalists were living, and I realized that the guy had disappeared, did I realize it was my own perspiration swamping me because I was so frightened, and because while I was driving away I was crashing into parked cars in my panic to escape from this guy. I suppose that's the nearest I've come, so far as I know, to being kidnapped, although on other occasions I have obviously seen men in cars in Beirut whom I have been troubled about.
There's an effort in Lebanon now to make Beirut part of a new militia-free zone. What's behind this effort? Would you explain it to us?
Well, it really began with the Taif Agreement, the agreement of Lebanese members of parliament under the auspices of Saudi Arabia, when they met at the Saudi town of Taif and decided that while they would try and keep the confessional structure of the original government, which was imposed by the French in 1943, they would make some changes to it. These changes effectively would mean that while the president would remain a Christian Maronite, he would have fewer powers, and while the prime minister would remain a Sunni Muslim, he would have more powers. In fact, what it did is it gave more political power to the Muslims, who are now in a majority in Lebanon, and less to the Christians, who are now in a minority in Lebanon. 40 or 50 years ago, the figures were the other way around, and the government made more sense, or at least the structure of the government made more sense then. The second part of the Taif Agreement was that there would be an elected president who would be accepted internationally. There was a man called Reni Muawad who was savagely murdered about a week after he took office, and then after him the election of another man, President Elias Hrawi, who is now the president of Lebanon. General Michel Aoun, the Christian army leader who was appointed an interim prime minister by a former president, Amin Gemayel, then refused to accept the Taif Agreement and refused to accept Hrawi's power. And it was the destruction of Aoun's power which was necessary to achieve the implementation of Taif, although there is one important factor that has to be brought in. Syria wanted Aoun's power destroyed. Syria has 40,000 troops in Lebanon. Syria backed the Taif Agreement and clearly believed that if a new government, which would of course be a pro-Syrian government, could be installed, Lebanon, or at least the capital city, would be a city, a country friendly towards Syria, would not be consorting in Syria's eyes with Syria's enemies, particularly with Israel. So the Syrians played a leading role in bringing about the Taif Agreement, and they played an even more leading role in getting rid of General Aoun with international acceptance. And their leading role, of course, was it was their guns and their aeroplanes that bombarded him out of the presidential palace.
So in the meantime, how much of the militias have actually been driven out?
The militias weren't driven out. They were persuaded to go, mainly because the Syrians threatened them if they didn't. In theory, militia power has disappeared from Beirut. For example, when I drove around the city as the militias were leaving, I could see trucks carrying the Shiite Muslim Amal militias' heavy ordnance out of the south of the city. I then crossed and drove through the deserted and ruined port area, and I could see the Christian phalangists driving truckloads of ammunition, much of it Jordanian, much of it Iraqi, some of it American, out of the eastern side of the city. So the ammunition left, the guns left, and in theory, so did the militia men. But the militias come from the people. They live in Beirut. And I don't believe for a moment that they didn't later return to the city without their heavy guns. And indeed, there's proof of it, because in the days that followed, even on a few days ago when I was in Beirut on Thursday and then again Friday morning, I saw a Mercedes full of men with pump-action shotguns, bearded men staring out the window as I drove on my way to the airport. At one checkpoint, which is meant to have been dismantled, there were no militiamen on it, but in a waste lot next to it, there was a Volvo car with three bearded men in. This is the unarmed or comparatively unarmed version of the militias still in being. Suspicion is still there, and so is danger.
With the militias leaving, or at least theoretically leaving, Beirut, are more people coming back to Beirut?
There's no sign of it yet, although what you do notice, for example, is that the courses at the American University in Beirut, one of the finest universities in the Middle East, have got back to normal structure. Students are returning from East Beirut, which they were too frightened to do before, to the campus, the main campus in West Beirut. You notice a lot of things like shops reopening, people repainting gas stations. There are plans to reopen and rebuild the wreckage of the old Commodore Hotel, which used to be a press headquarters in Beirut. You see it as well in new nightclubs, new restaurants are opening, and also, of course, in higher prices. There are clear signs of a city that's being reborn. But, as I said before, I'll wait to see if all those gunmen really disappear before I believe this is a new, safe Beirut, heading back towards the security that it seemed to have before 1975.
Robert Fisk is my guest, and he's one of two foreign journalists still living in Beirut. He's been covering Lebanon for the past 14 years. He writes for the British paper The Independent, and he's written a new book called Pity the Nation. How is the Gulf crisis affecting life in Beirut?
In a Lebanese sense, quite profitably at the moment, and for a country that prides itself on being 10% men, I suppose that's only natural. One of the things that has happened remarkably is there's been an enormous transit of US dollar bills through Beirut. The reason for this is quite simple. When Iraq invaded Kuwait, it reduced the value and, in fact, effectively wiped out the existence of the Kuwaiti dinar. The speed with which this happened and the huge millions of dollars in savings that were wiped out overnight by the devaluation and disappearance of this currency made many Gulf Arabs from other Gulf states, the Emirates, Oman, and particularly Saudi Arabia, immediately lose their trust in their own local currencies, currencies like the Saudi rial. The actual value of those currencies was not reduced on the markets, but people in those countries immediately began to convert their local currencies into US dollars, which they knew would not disappear. And the Lebanese, being entrepreneurs and businessmen, immediately began to funnel currency through Beirut, taking, of course, the usual 10% check off it, and making money into the progress. Politically, there's a much darker scene. There's no doubt that the huge number of Palestinians in the city of Sidon, which is only 12 to 15 miles south of Beirut, have very much taken the Iraqi side. The PLO basically controls the camps there. There are 15,000 armed Palestinian guerrillas, most of them loyal to the PLO. So the streets there are plastered with Saddam Hussein portraits, which is not, of course, the case in Beirut, where it's President Assad of Syria whose picture is on the streets, alongside those of various Lebanese martyrs, as they call themselves. In northern Lebanon, the Iraqi Ba'ath Party, which has always existed there, has certainly grown stronger. And there has been a certain amount, not so much as has been stated in newspapers, but a certain amount of sanctions busting by people sending powdered milk and some foodstuffs across from Lebanon through Syria and then smuggled across the Syrian-Iraqi border.
Now, Syria has 40,000 soldiers in Lebanon now, and Syria is an opponent of Iraq. So how is that playing out now in terms of the Gulf crisis?
Well, for the moment, Syria is very satisfied with the situation in Beirut vis-a-vis the Gulf crisis, because you have to remember that Saddam Hussein's principal ally inside Lebanon was none other than General Michel Aoun. It was Aoun who was the only Lebanese leader who used to attend Iraqi Embassy National Day and Ba'ath Party anniversaries at the embassy in East Beirut. It was Aoun who received most of his ammunition last year. Ordnance which he fired with artillery at the Syrians. Most of that ordnance came from Iraq, which the Iraqis publicly announced that they sent to him. Indeed, ships carrying Iraqi anti-aircraft missiles, Iraqi 155mm shells, arrived regularly in Aoun's enclave. So his destruction, Aoun's effective destruction on October 13, was a victory of Syria over Iraq. There are those people, many people in Lebanon, who believe that America, despite denials to the contrary, effectively gave Syria a green light to get rid of Aoun, because in America's eyes, here was a man who in miniature also, to some extent, represented the Iraqi leader. General Aoun resisted all international efforts to get him to lay down his guns and accept the legal authority of Lebanon, i.e. President Elias Rawi. He refused, even under economic blockade, to give up. There's an obvious parallel with Iraq. He was a man who openly boasted of his own links with Iraq. And I think there must have been a feeling in Washington as well that it would do Saddam Hussein good to see those television tapes of the shells bursting around the presidential palace, which drove Michel Aoun out of power. So at the moment, and one has to say at the moment because things change so quickly in Lebanon, President Assad is riding pretty high there in his hostility towards Iraq.
Since Syria does have 40,000 soldiers in Lebanon, can you maybe explain a little bit about of the background between Syria and Lebanon and what Syria is doing in Lebanon now?
Well, historically, the connection is undeniable. Until the French received the League of Nations mandate to control Syria after the First World War in 1920, what is now Lebanon was part of Syria. If I go into old bookshops near my home in West Beirut, for example, and pick up old coloured postcards of Beirut, it says Beirut, Syria, not Beirut, Lebanon, because Lebanon as a state then didn't exist. It was the French that carved out Lebanon and made Beirut its capital and handed over power in Lebanon to the Christian Maronites, who had always looked to Paris rather than Damascus in loyalty. It's always been said since by Syria's critics, of whom there are many, that Syria wanted to annex Lebanon to get it back. I'm not sure you can annex a country that was formerly part of your own country anyway, but I don't in fact think Syria wants that. It has not done to Lebanon in 14 years what Saddam Hussein has done to Kuwait in 3 months. It has not put its flag on the presidential palace. It has not destroyed the Lebanese government. In fact, it's tried to rebuild it. It has not introduced its currency into Lebanon. It has not introduced its political parties into Lebanon. But Syria is there with a very important political and strategic role in its own eyes. The first is it's frightened that Lebanon could be a back road for the Israelis to invade Syria, and it was very much consolidated in this opinion when the Israelis invaded Lebanon in 1982 and got as far, indeed further north than Beirut. And secondly, Syria itself is made up of a patchwork of different communities, much like Lebanon. And before President Assad took power, there was a good deal of discontent and fighting within Syria, much as there has been since in Lebanon. And I think Assad has always been fearful that the broken state of Lebanon, the fighting between the militias there, could spill over into Syria and reignite the old Syrian civil war. So those 40,000 troops are there to repress the violence that threatens Syria, to prevent a Syrian, to prevent an Israeli attack into Syria, and of course to make sure that Lebanon remains a pliant, friendly, pro-Syrian state, i.e. that the Lebanese will not have the independence that they would like.
Let's take a short break and then we'll talk some more. My guest is British journalist Robert Fisk, and he's one of two foreign journalists still living in Beirut. Fisk has been covering Lebanon for the past 14 years. He writes for the British paper The Independent, and he's written a new book called Pity the Nation. This is Fresh Air. British journalist Robert Fisk is my guest, author of the new book Pity the Nation, The Abduction of Lebanon. If there is a fighting war in the Gulf, what do you think is going to happen in Lebanon? Do you think Lebanon would be a target? Do you think it would participate in the fighting?
Well, I think and I fear, and I hope there won't be a war, but I fear the result of a war would be that Americans would not be able to feel safe anywhere in the Middle East for months or years to come. And of course, that would apply to Lebanon too. It would undoubtedly undermine the position of the very fragile new unity in Beirut. It would undermine the position of the Lebanese government. But you see, it would also undermine the position of the Jordanians, undermine the position of President Mubarak of Egypt. One of the things which I find living in Beirut and visiting the Gulf so much and spending so much time in Saudi Arabia is that things which are said in Washington, which make so much sense over here, and which sound perfectly good sense to me when I'm here at the moment, for example, don't sound anything like as rational when you hear them in the Middle East. The distance, the different culture, the different religion means that, in a way, people out there receive the messages, receive the words, clearly, no doubt, but with a completely different temperament and frame of mind.
Can you give an example of that?
Well, I'll give you a perfect example, I think. When President Bush sent his soldiers, when he made the decision to send American troops to Saudi Arabia on August 6th and 7th, he publicized what he was doing to the Arabs, promising them that Kuwait would be liberated, along the lines that America was a great liberator. This was the country which liberated Europe from the Nazis in 1944-45. And that, of course, is historically perfectly correct. And sitting here in the United States, I can see why he said it, and I can see that it's historically true. The Arabs, however, are not the slightest bit interested in who liberated Europe in 1944 and 45. In their eyes, America is not the liberator of Europe, it's the backer of Israel, and for the Arabs, Israel is their enemy. So the moment Mr. Bush sent troops to Saudi Arabia, while it may have looked logical here, and while it may have been necessary for the Saudi government, it introduced immediately, because of the Israeli factor, a contradiction into what was happening.
Do you think that Israeli-Palestinian relations should be part of what's negotiated if there are negotiations between Iraq and the United States?
I think it's so easy to go back into retrospect, but I fear we tend to do it rather a lot out in the Middle East. Looking back now to President Bush's original statement, the reasons why he was sending American military forces to the Gulf, there were four basic reasons, of which the most important, of course, were security of the region with unconditional withdrawal of Iraq from Kuwait, the restoration of the legitimate Kuwaiti government, and protection of American lives. They were the four reasons. Looking back on it, I wonder if the Americans couldn't have been a little bolder than that, and whether they might have avoided a lot of the grief that Mr. Bush and Mr. Baker are going through now, if at that early stage they couldn't have said, look, we're talking about a new world order, and that's got to apply to all the Middle East, not just to Iraq and Kuwait and Saudi Arabia, and that America now intends to use all its political pressure, its influence in the region, to solve all the injustices there, not just the injustice done to the Kuwaitis. If Mr. Bush could have done that, and he would, of course, have been linking the issue of the Palestinian question, would have got a lot more trust among ordinary Arabs, not just the leaders who say the things that Washington wants to hear, but he would also have taken away from Saddam Hussein the propaganda which he, Saddam, made when he made the linkage between the Palestinian question and the Kuwaiti invasion. In a way, by not having the ability or perhaps the courage to make that linkage themselves, the Americans gave the propaganda victory to the Iraqis.
What would you advise George Bush to do now with this January 15th deadline looming?
My God, Terry Gross, you're pushing me there.
Hang on. No, I'm just wondering, from your perspective, what you think.
British reporter tells the President of the United States what to do.
Well,
in his English
accent. You're not going to talk to him anyway, so it's all hypothetical.
Well, look, I'm afraid one of the problems in the Middle East is that the problems there are not just rooted in individual actions. They're rooted in history, in betrayals by the West, in broken promises, the Balfour Declaration, in broken promises by the British to Jews and Arabs alike, broken promises by the Americans. One of the things Mr. Bush has got to do before he makes any further declarations, I suspect, is decide whether America is going to be even-handed in the Middle East or not. Now, in very simple terms, for example, Mr. Bush is extremely rhetorical in his anger about the failure of Saddam Hussein to obey UN Security Council resolutions. Israel has many times failed to obey UN Security Council resolutions without finding 500,000 American troops turning up on its doorstep. Now, there is clearly here a message for the Arabs. America may wish to be an honest broker, it may wish to be neutral, but it does not act in a neutral way at the end of the day. One also has to take into account the fact that however much it may be denied in Washington, the Arabs have no doubt that the Americans are in the Middle East for basically economic reasons over oil. If Saudi Arabia was just a beach with a few nomads and a few camels, Americans would not be sending 500,000 men to defend it from Iraq and threatening to invade Iraq. So that's a starter. First of all, perhaps the American administration has to decide, is it going to be even-handed in the future, or is it going to allow itself to continue to be influenced by various lobbies there, the lobbies of rich Arab states, the lobbies perhaps of the Israelis? That's the first question that they're going to have to decide. And if they could decide it before going to war, it might save a lot of tragedy afterwards. In the short term, I'm afraid that at the end of the day, so many errors have been made in the preceding years and even the preceding months that it's difficult to see how the Americans can unlock all the doors which they've locked behind them. Mr. Saddam Hussein can do this easily because he runs a very vicious and savage police state. He rules through fear. And therefore, he doesn't have to make excuses. He can invade Iran 1 year, withdraw his troops the next, call it a victory, and lose 1 million men. Mr. Bush can't do that because he lives and runs a democracy. And I think that one of the problems that's occurred since the beginning of this crisis is that the president and his advisors have found themselves constantly responding to what Iraq does, constantly making comments in response to what Saddam Hussein does. It doesn't produce anything. What it does is it makes more and more rhetorical statements of aim which were never intended in the first place. A good example of this is what happened in Lebanon in 82. The Americans came there with the same good intentions they've gone to the Gulf now. They started off with limited aims, the withdrawal of a foreign army or foreign armies from Lebanon, which is what the aim is in Kuwait. But suddenly, we had Mr. Reagan saying that the withdrawal of these armies and peace in Lebanon was essential to American interests throughout the Middle East. Now we started off with these four basic aims of the president, now President Bush in Kuwait, and within months, we've got huge rhetorical moral aims added to it. The potential destruction of Iraq, freedom from aggression, the end of a man who's claimed to be worse than Hitler, the American way of life is at stake. So what happened is, as the time has gone by, America has constantly widened and broadened the moral aims of why it's in Saudi Arabia, and thus locked itself into ever larger aspirations which it has to meet, and which I don't think it's going to be able to meet. One thing Mr. Bush could do is perhaps pull back a little bit on these moral aims and try and keep things carefully defined and refined down to the original aim of this business, which is to get Iraq out of Kuwait.
How much longer do you think you will continue to live in Beirut?
Well, every year or two, I tell myself it'll be the last one. I don't want to spend the rest of my life in Beirut. I certainly don't want to risk dying there for much longer. It depends. You know, it's a bit like following a huge drama, like reading a great book, like reading Tolstoy. After you get so wrapped into following the story and witnessing the events, you always have a feeling as a journalist of saying, well, I've seen all this, and maybe I'd like to stay just to see what happens in the next chapter. And I guess over the years, that's what I've done so far, and I wouldn't want to make any promises that I don't want to see one more chapter.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
My guest has been British journalist Robert Fisk, and he's the author of a new book about Lebanon called Pity the Nation, The Abduction of Lebanon. Next time, reporter Hedrick Smith on Life Today in the Soviet Union. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. After years of bald jokes, bald insults, bald stereotypes, and being referred to as a chrome dome, journalist Richard Sandomir decided to strike back. Coming up, Sandomir on what he calls his love letter to his unhaired brethren, his new book, Bald Like Me. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new recording of the Lydian String Quartet, performing Charles Ives' string quartets. Lloyd says it's one of the best chamber music recordings ever made. And once J.R. Ewing was the ultimate in corporate evil, but that was before the likes of Ivan Boesky and Leona Helmsley. Maureen Corrigan has some thoughts about Dallas in the 90s. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Iraq has officially accepted President Bush's offer to send Secretary of State James Baker to Baghdad and to have Iraqi Foreign Minister Tariq Aziz visit Washington to talk about the Persian Gulf crisis. Appearing today before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, Baker described the message that he will take to Iraq. NPR's Ted Clark reports.
Saddam Hussein must comply fully with UN resolutions calling on him to withdraw from Kuwait, restore the legitimate government there, and free all hostages, Secretary Baker insisted. He said he's not going to Baghdad to negotiate on these points. He gave a preview of the argument he'll make to Saddam Hussein.
Peace is your only sensible option. You can choose peace by respecting the will of the international community. But if you fail to do so, you will risk all. The choice is yours.
Baker pointed out that Kuwait has expressed a willingness to discuss Iraqi-Kuwaiti disputes after Saddam's forces have left. Many Democrats on the committee urged more time for the sanctions to work, but Baker said no one can say that sanctions alone will force Saddam Hussein to pull out of Kuwait. The best way to achieve that goal, Baker said, is to convince Saddam Hussein that war is a real possibility. This is Ted Clark in Washington.
Former Texas Governor John Conley and a millionaire Texas oil man are now in Iraq trying to free some energy workers held hostage there. NPR's John Burnett reports.
John Conley and Oscar Wyatt, chairman of the Houston-based Coastal Corporation, flew to Iraq over the weekend with a load of medical supplies to try and negotiate the release of U.S. hostages. A spokesman at Coastal Corporation confirmed that Connolly and Wyatt had met with Iraqi officials, including Hussein Kamil Hassan, Minister of Industry and Oil, and the son-in-law of President Saddam Hussein. The Coastal Corporation has no employees being held in Iraq, but prior to the August 2nd invasion, the huge energy company was one of Iraq's largest customers, buying an average of 250,000 barrels of oil a day. Connolly, the failed 1980 presidential candidate who went bankrupt in the late 80s, sits on Coastal's board of directors. Connolly and Wyatt hope to add their names to the list of people, such as Jesse Jackson and Muhammad Ali, who have escorted hostages home from Iraq. This is John Burnett reporting.
The chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff says if there is war in the Persian Gulf, that the U.S. plans to use overwhelming force to win. General Colin Powell, speaking in London, said Iraq has to pull out of Kuwait in order to avert war. And in his words, the U.S. is not going to blink on this one. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up over 30.5 points to close at 2,610.40 on volume of some 206 million shares. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Later on the show, we talk about rugs, and we don't mean carpet. The first CD devoted to the string quartet music of Charles Ives has just been released. The four pieces are performed by the Lydian String Quartet, and classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz says it's one of the best chamber music recordings ever made.
Charles Ives may be the most American of all American composers. but his music still isn't as well known or widely admired as it ought to be. And his chamber music, which includes some of his greatest work, is even less familiar than his large orchestral pieces, his Concord piano sonata, or his marvelous songs. The string quartet may be the most European of musical forms, but as with every other form Ives employed, he soon made it his own. He composed his first quartet in 1896, and you can still hear the Middle European influences, the classical forms and thick textures of Brahms and Dvorak. When Dvorak borrowed American themes, he gave them the flavor of Czech folk music, but the hymn tunes and songs that Ives uses give even his most traditional European forms a more authentically American sound. Ives began his second quartet in 1907 and took 6 years to finish it. In it, he experiments with new and freer forms. Ives said this quartet was about four men who converse, discuss, argue, fight, shake hands, shut up, then walk up the mountainside to view the firmament. In the second movement, Arguments, the debate is aesthetic as well as political. The players quote Columbia, the Gem of the Ocean, Marching Through Georgia, Tchaikovsky's Pathetic Symphony, the Brahms Second, and even the Beethoven Ninth. Ives also wrote two short contrasting pieces that he was planning to incorporate into another string quartet: Hymn, which is a darkly solemn movement with added string bass, and the Wild Halloween with piano and bass drum. The Lydian Quartet is one of the best chamber groups in the country. They were founded 10 years ago by four women. 2 years ago, their first violinist, who was born in Fiji, was asked by the government of New Zealand to start a new group there. It was an offer she couldn't refuse. So the remaining original members, violinist Judith Eisenberg, violist Mary Ruth Ray, and cellist Rhonda Ryder, were joined by violinist Daniel Stepner, who is not only a much-admired Baroque player, but also an Ives specialist. His 1982 recording of Ives's violin sonatas with pianist John Kirkpatrick, who is a friend of Ives himself, is one of the best Ives recordings ever made, and so is this recording of Ives' quartets. This is playing in the great tradition, rhythmically alive, with a big, bold, warmly beautiful sound. and the players show the kind of subtle consideration for each other, the team spirit that only the very greatest chamber ensembles have ever been able to master. I hope these moving performances will help find a bigger audience for these extraordinary works.
Lord Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed the string quartets of Charles Ives on the Centaur label. This is Fresh Air. Richard Sandomir is tired of bald jokes, but not too tired to write a humorous book about baldness. His new book is Bald Like Me, The Hair-Raising Adventures of Bald Man. The book is filled with put-downs of men with too much hair, like Ted Koppel and Don King. It also celebrates bald men in history and praises bald congressmen, actors, and athletes who dare to face a TV camera without a piece. But journalist Sandomir also investigated hair pieces and hair replacement techniques. I asked Richard Sandomir to describe the top of his head.
I have a vast tundra on top of my head. I have the side fringes, but it's a large tundra in the middle of the head. So I have the bald spot and nothing up front, but something on the sides.
Have you ever been really self-conscious about being bald?
Yeah, I started going bald when I was around 22, and for about 5 or 6 years, it really did make me feel self-conscious. So for a few weeks during those years, I combed the side hairs to the middle, and that didn't do much for me. Any breeze or wind would knock that out. And I had been making fun of toupees for a long time when I had hair, so I figured I could not be hypocritical and go for a toupee. But I was self-conscious for about 5 or 6 years until I realized that there was an external hair threat against people like me, and that they were conspiring to make men like me feel like lesser men because we are lesser haired.
Now, as part of your research, though, you went shopping for a toupee.
Yes, I did.
And one of the things that you learned is that people in the biz really hate the word toupee.
They like the word hairpiece. I think they like rug even less than,
right.
than they like toupee. Yeah, toupee gives the connotation of the old silent movies where hairpieces would fall into soup. So I referred to it as a toupee as often as I could. And I also found that they were rather and obviously anti-bald. That's part of their shtick. And they made me feel like I'd only be a full and complete and handsome man if I had a full and complete head of hair.
Give us a sense of the type of sales pitch you ran into when you were shopping for a toupee.
Well, some of it is very subtle. They would say, well, you know, baldness is fine, but hair is better. I was pitched by Frank Sinatra's hairpiece maker, Howard Cosell's hairpiece maker. And the Howard Cosell hairpiece maker, they have an interesting sales pitch that they have toupees with names. El Conquistador, El Capitan, things like that. There was one place, a place that makes hairpieces that are semi-permanently attached, where she had a picture hanging up behind her with pictures of various shots of hair transplants going on with blood pouring down the guy's face. And I felt that was probably one way to deter one from a hair transplant, and if you were inclined to buy these semi-permanent hair pieces.
Well, you met the star of hair pieces, Cy Sperling.
Yes.
President of the Hair Club for Men. And what's his motto?
I'm not only the president, I'm a client.
How did you meet him?
I just called him up. He's very public relations oriented, and as long as you spell his name right, I don't think he cares what you say about him. I call him the enemy of my people. So I called him that on TV recently, and he just goes on to his spiel, and I I have no problem with his reaction to it. I wish he'd close up shop, but he's not going to. He has 30,000 clients.
Now, you found out Cy Sperling used to actually sell carpets.
Yes, it was a touching little moment during our 2 or 3 hours together, and his son and daughter work with him. His son also wears a Cy piece. And his daughter was sitting there, a very charming, giggly young woman, and she was, I think it came up towards the end where she said, "Well, Daddy, should we tell him what you did before?" And he reluctantly said, "Well, okay, I guess so." And he said, "Daddy used to sell carpeting." So a rug man before a rug man.
Does Cy Sperling make pieces or weaves?
He's a weave maker.
Oh, so...
I don't even know if he admits that they're weaves. He calls them, I believe, hair systems.
So, what's the difference between a hair piece and a hair weave?
As far as I know, not much beyond the method of attachment. A hair piece is generally attached with double back tape, glue, and or metal clips, which snap into the hair on the sides. And a hair weave is a semi-permanent attachment with a nylon filament that is sewn into the fringe hair and connects the hair piece to your real hair.
Did you try a weave at all?
No, I did not want to do that because I would not be able to take it off unless I went back to the place that did it. I felt that a hairpiece was the easiest thing to have in my testing of people's attitudes towards false hair because I was too far gone from minoxidil, which is only for people who have just started losing hair. I was too far gone for hair transplants. I didn't want to do the weave, and a toupee is removable at night and or at any time you want to take it off.
So what'd you buy?
I bought a hair piece. It cost me $850. And I bought it from a man named Lewis, who, in my research, was about the nicest guy I found. He was, although anti-bald, he was not real high pressure, and he didn't seem to mind the fact that I was writing a book. Most people I didn't tell, and depending on the attitude of the person up to a certain point in the sales pitch, I might or might not tell them. And he measured me for it using such high-tech materials as saran wrap and magic marker. And in a few weeks, he, you know, matched up my hair with some hair that was collected from Italian peasant women. And then in a few weeks, it came back, and it was styled for me. And it had to be cut. It was like a Frank Zappa cut when it first came in because it was just this mass of ringlets. And finally, you know, when it was put on my head the first time, it looked the best. But after that, you can't have your stylist live with you. And it was just, it was a terrible thing to have in my head. I just felt I was denying my bald soul.
Well, how did you look?
Well, the funny thing is, there are people who write about phantom limbs and you know, the leg has been cut off and they still feel it, they itch it. Well, whenever I had the hairpiece on, I felt like I could see my scalp. And it was sort of like my phantom scalp, and it was always there for me. I just could look right through it. Some people thought I looked good. Some people thought I looked absolutely awful with it. The women were kinder, and all my male friends laughed heartily and endlessly when they saw me. I gathered about 5 of them at a Chinese restaurant, and they were rather amused, and their comments are included in a section in the book called Three Haired Men and a Baldy.
So when you were wearing a toupee,
yes.
Do you think that strangers, when they saw you, knew it was a toupee?
I didn't ask them, but I was a complete paranoid that they knew, and it really made me feel like I was skulking around the streets, scared that people would reveal me as the fig-haired fraud that I was.
Do you feel that you were ever held back by anything because of being bald, or that anybody looked down on you, or didn't want to go out with you, or whatever because of it?
Well, I think that I internalized what I thought were women's feelings, and it exacerbated my usual shyness. But I don't think I had any more or less luck with women significantly because I was bald as compared to when I was haired. If I could tell the story about how I met my current girlfriend, she met me as a rugged person. I was in Disney World, and I met her because she was another reporter on this junket. And for 3 days, she saw me in Disney World wearing this hairpiece. Finally, when we got back to New York, and she lives nearby, I asked her for a date, and we went out. And the first question I asked her, beyond how are you, is, do you like my hair? And she said, yes. I said, do you like the way I style it? She said, yes. I said, do you think it's real? And she said, it's not. I said, no. And afterwards, I said, after dinner, I will take it off. And in between, I told her about the research for the book. And then we got back. And I went into the bathroom and spent about 5 or 10 minutes taking it off and restyling my fringe hair. And I walked slowly, very slowly, trembling almost, into her living room. And there she sat, reading something. And she looked up with an angelic face. And she said, "Now that's better." And it made me feel so good. And we've been together ever since. And I asked her if she had any inkling that it was fake hair. And she said, just a slight bit, because her ex-husband had worn a succession of very bad hair pieces. And compared with his, mine looked great, she said. But she felt that I was holding something back in my personality by wearing it. And once it came off, I was able to really reveal my bald soul.
Do you think bald men face discrimination?
I think it's very subtle. I think bald men probably get lesser consideration for certain jobs because they are perceived as less dynamic because they are less haired. I think it could also work in our favor because it gives us a sense of maturity that you know, we may look older than we are.
What about when we're talking about really powerful people, like, say, Gorbachev? I mean, he certainly doesn't wear a toupee.
Thank God for that. He does have that little oil slick, but he's a great, powerful leader. But, of course, as the fates would have it, he has to be succeeded by an overhaired person because the Russian succession has always gone bald-haired, 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 from Lenin to Gorbachev. It is they're always succeeded from Lenin to Stalin to Khrushchev to Brezhnev to Andropov to Chernenko to
I can't believe you're keeping track
to
of
Gorbachev.
This. Do you have a
yes.
chart on your wall?
No, I've memorized it, Terry. So Yeltsin
I'm really glad you've done your research.
Well, I'm a reporter. So Yeltsin has to succeed Gorbachev or some overhaired person, but Yeltsin seems to be in the best position, at least for his obvious efforts so far.
Well, Richard Sandomir, thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
Richard Sandomir's new book is Bald Like Me.
All of me. Why not take all of me? Can't you see I'm no good without you? Take my lips, I want to lose them. Take my arms, I'll never use them. Your goodbye left me with eyes that cry. How can I get along without you? You took the path that once was my heart.
This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is joining us from NPR in Washington. Noah, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Hi, Terry. Secretary of State James Baker and CIA Director William Webster testify before a Senate committee about the standoff in the Persian Gulf. Also, General Colin Powell, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, talks today about a permanent military presence in the Gulf region, a report on the president's hopes for economic progress and increased cooperation in Latin America, also a discussion of the difficulties some of the new democracies there are having dealing with the amnesty issue, what to do about the members of the military accused of human rights abuses in previous years. And critic Bob Mondello has a review of the new film, The Grifters.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Critic Maureen Corrigan used to be a regular at Dallas parties, hanging out in someone's living room, eating ribs, drinking beer, and watching JR wreak havoc on other people's lives. But she says nobody has Dallas parties anymore. Dallas isn't what it used to be.
JR, look around here. What do you see?
Daddy's company. Our company, our son's company.
You don't know why April's dead, do you? It's because of money. And oil, the very thing that built this company. She didn't die because she was April Stevens. She died because she was April Ewing, Bobby Ewing's wife, Mrs. Ewing Oil.
You can't blame the oil.
To hell with the oil business.
There it is, folks, the elegy for the 80s. Dialogue like this makes me think that Dallas's days are numbered. In seasons past, whenever Bobby gave JR a lecture like the one you just heard about his low-down business deals and philandering, JR would just look us viewers in the eye and smile, his sly JR smile. What a chump that Bobby is, we all thought. But nowadays, Bobby always gets the last pious word, and J.R. just looks chastened, like he's been caught writing bad checks to the United Way. In the kinder, gentler 90s, greed isn't good anymore. I've watched Dallas since it debuted in 1978, and I really can't defend it as a profound viewing experience. The plots have always been as shallow as Cliff Barnes's oil wells. Among other silly things, we viewers have been expected to believe that a whole season of Dallas, which revolved around Bobby's death, was just a bad dream, and that Bobby and J.R. run a multi-zillion dollar oil company all by themselves. Have you ever seen anyone else in the Ewing Oil Building besides those three secretaries? But ridiculous as it's been, Dallas was once the number one show in the country. The episode on November 21, 1980, that revealed who shot J.R. broke the existing record for the most widely watched TV episode of all time. If you agree, like I do, with critic Todd Gitlin, that TV is our national dream factory, then it's intriguing to think about the distorted images of our desires and fears that Dallas has conjured up for us. The unmoved mover of Dallas's world is J.R., brilliantly played by the underrated Larry Hagman. J.R. is a quintessential American type, the trickster. He's in the same tradition as Melville's confidence man and Twain's Huck Finn. We Americans have always loved tricksters and wanted to be like them because they just laugh away our Puritan manners and morals. But all the second-rate con artists who flourished in the 80s, Leona Helmsley, Ivan Boesky, Michael Milken, have made the 90s a hostile time for genuine tricksters. J.R. is losing his popularity because of the ineptitude of his real-life imitators. This season, J.R. is still trying to stir up trouble, but he operates in a strangely depopulated Dallas. Miss Ellie, Sue Ellen, Pam, and Lucy have all left town. 2 weeks ago, April was murdered by terrorists, and J.R. fired his loyal secretary, Sly. The only people left to outwit are Banal Bobby, Cliff Barnes, and those beefy old cowhands, George Kennedy and Howard Keel. No wonder the impish Hagman is looking haggard these days. Maybe when people like J.R. lose their nasty entrepreneurial energy, they lose their humor, too.
Maureen Corrigan teaches at Georgetown University. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional grants are provided by the National Endowment for the Arts and Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs. 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, journalist Hedrick Smith on The New Russians, the Gorbachev-era follow-up to his bestseller, The Russians. And some kitchen science with Harold McGee. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.